You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, in Syria, President Bashar al-Assad has now spent nearly 2 years fighting his own people to keep his family's business in operation. He surely can't last forever, so who might replace him? And why has the US started calling some of his opponents terrorists? We'll find out. We'll be interviewing veteran New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik about his new book, Winter, and about much else besides.
Nobody has a hard time loving summer, and spring is the cheapest subject a poet can have, and fall is a fairly self-evident subject for a poet, too, or a painter. Winter is deeply, deeply ambivalent. It's deeply ambivalent in our firsthand experience of it, and it's deeply ambivalent in the ways that we imagine it in art.
Elsewhere in the United States, the common first world hobby of fretting over standards of high school education is given added legitimacy by the publication of two new reports confirming that Southeast Asian kids are much more likely to understand the statistics the reports contain than American ones. We'll ask why. Ahead of this weekend's parliamentary election in Japan, we'll have the latest forecasts from the streets of Tokyo.
Shinzo Abe is a former prime minister. You know, he suggested a fairly radical revision of the pacifist constitution that would give the military more powers or more authority to act like a military.
And we'll be considering the sounds of the ocean and explaining why not nearly enough of them sound like this anymore. All of that plus one or two songs not by Wales ahead in the next hour on Midori House. But before any or indeed all of that, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, has had more surgery in Cuba today for a recurrence of cancer that has thrown his future into jeopardy. The actor Sean Penn has praised him at a candlelit vigil held in the Bolivian capital La Paz in support of the ailing leader.
We admire President Chavez for his courage, for his fair-mindedness. He is one of the most important forces we've had on this planet, and I will wish him nothing but that great strength he has shown over and over again. I do it in love, and I do it in gratitude.
Two Britons linked to the alleged drug smuggler Lindsay Sandiford were both charged with drug trafficking in an Indonesian court today. Rachel Dougal and Paul Beals, who were both arrested in May for their involvement in an alleged £1.6 million cocaine smuggling ring, appeared in a court on the island resort of Bali. Here, the UK government has today condemned what it called the disgraceful attacks on police officers after 8 days of violence in Northern Ireland, following a Belfast Council decision to limit the flying of the Union flag to designated days only. The Secretary of State for Northern Ireland is Theresa Villiers.
Yesterday evening, a masked gang threw a petrol bomb inside an unmarked police car. A young policewoman narrowly escaped very serious injury. This is now being treated by the police as attempted murder. As I made very clear in the House last Wednesday, there can be absolutely no excuse or justification for this kind of thuggish and lawless behaviour. It is despicable, we condemn it unreservedly, and it must stop immediately.
United States carrier Delta Airlines has bought Singapore Airlines' 49% stake in Britain's Virgin Atlantic for $360 million and agreed a transatlantic joint venture with Virgin. Under the joint venture, both airlines will share costs and revenues on routes between Britain and North America. The pair plan to cooperate on services between New York and London, with a total of 9 daily round-trip flights from London Heathrow to John F. Kennedy International Airport and Newark Liberty International Airport. Artists taking part in the Nobel Peace Prize concert in Oslo tonight said the European Union did deserve to win the award. The concert will honour the 55-year-old organisation for helping transform Europe from a continent of wars to a continent of peace in the decades since World War II. British actor Gerald Butler will co-host the event.
watching Gladiator, the very opening, you still, even there, you have the Huns fighting the Italians, the Romans. It never stopped. And we came to live like that. And I think nowadays we take it for granted in a way that we live in peaceful times. And I think this is what is beautiful about this award is to remind us that we can't ever take peace for granted. And these member states are so interwoven socially, economically, in every way that war is almost impossible. So this is 60 years of peace. And that is something pretty incredible.
And finally, grieving pet owners in Singapore can soon share their feelings about their furred family members after they go off to the great beyond via obituaries in the city-state's largest newspaper. From Sunday, the Straits Times Pets sections will let pet owners publish goodbye messages to their favourite non-human companions along with an accompanying photograph. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Actors, is there nothing they don't know? It's 1806 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London-으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. The imminent downfall of Bashar al-Assad has been predicted frequently in the last 18 months. While his unlovely Ba'athist regime has proved remarkably resilient, it does seem, at the risk of tempting fate, that his tactic of pulverising every faintly hostile district of his own country is unlikely to work out well in the long term. Which means, of course, that someone else is going to end up in charge of Syria. And since the first stirrings of revolution in Tunisia 2 years ago this month, the entire Arab Spring has started to resemble a frightful cautionary tale in the wisdom of being careful what one wishes for. While most civilised opinion wishes that Assad would go, and soon, the possibility has to be admitted that whatever and whoever replaces him might actually be even worse. So how and should the West react to this challenge? Earlier, I discussed the available options with David Shanker, director of the programme on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. I wanted to know, as things presently stand, who is the likeliest next government of Syria?
When this revolution started, it was a largely secular endeavor. But over time, it has become, I think, given the nihilistic environment and the weapons coming from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, more and more Islamist. And if I had to be a betting man, I'd say that although Syria is not a particularly religious society or an Islamist society, like many of the other states in the region, I would have to guess that Syria may go Islamist in the end.
Well, just in the last day or so, we've seen the United States government designate one of the anti-Assad rebel groups, the Jabhat al-Nusra, as a terrorist group. What will that accomplish?
Right now, the U.S. government is not giving weapons or financial assistance to the Free Syria Army. It's providing non-lethal assistance. What this does, though, is that the U.S. has made a provision that American citizens can provide money to people who are buying arms. And I think that this is an effort to limit the transfer of funds to this al-Qaeda affiliate. At the same time, I think it's putting the United States firmly on record that they don't support actively the Jabhat al-Nusra. I think in terms of the U.S. policy, which has not been to arm the Free Syria Army from the beginning, it has inadvertently contributed to the rise of these Islamist al-Qaeda militias. But legally speaking, the U.S. government is trying to distance itself from this wing and to try and make it a pariah so that the non-Islamist militias will have a fighting chance when it's all over, because this is going to be determined, much like Libya, with militias refusing to give up arms. It's going to be a very messy situation.
What about this Syrian opposition council that the United States is trying to stand up? Does that have any support among Syrian people at all, or is this just the Iraqi National Congress all over again?
Well, I think, in terms of being hapless, it for the first year or year and a half, it sort of has been, I think, roughly analogous to the Iraqi National Congress. It has also been, I think, a useful excuse for the administration. They always say, well, the opposition has to get together before we can provide real support, either to the Free Syria Army or to other elements of the opposition. And so it has been sort of a bogeyman, a useful excuse for the administration not to move forward. The latest iteration of this organization is slightly more representative and more credible than those of the past, than the National Syrian Council. The National Syrian Council was set up in Turkey, and of course the AKP, the Erdogan administration, is essentially a Muslim Brotherhood government in Turkey, and it worked to Islamicize the Syrian opposition, and many people didn't believe that to be a representative body. This latest iteration actually includes many elements from inside, people coming, moving back and forth, local coordinating councils, and people from the Free Syria Army, and I think that it's got slightly more credibility on the inside, although it is not by any means a national or nationally recognized and accepted authority.
Presumably, when it comes to intervening in Middle Eastern affairs, the United States is by now firmly aware of the law that suggests history repeats itself the first time as tragedy and the second time as farce. Is there any kind of argument, honourable or otherwise, for the US and the wider West just to take a very old school isolationist stance and just say, look, this is entirely for the people of Syria to sort out. This isn't actually our problem.
Well, putting aside the humanitarian interest that 45,000 people have been killed so far, and that 40,000 or more are missing, and I think given the Assad regime, probably dead as well, so 100,000 dead. I'd say that there has been a real hesitancy from the Obama administration to get involved, that they think of this in terms of Iraq, of a slippery slope, but also in terms of Afghanistan in the 1980s when we armed the insurgents and this turned into al-Qaeda. But I think that there's a very real difference with what's happened in Syria. The absence of an American role, the delegation of the lead role to France, the Arab League, the United Nations, Turkey, and now Saudi and Qatar has led inextricably over time to the Islamization of the movement, of the opposition movement. And whereas once this could have been, I think, clearly a huge victory for secular forces in the region, for anti-radicalization, anti-militarization, it has moved toward, an Islamist, nihilistic, al-Qaeda, chaotic situation that is not going to be in U.S. interest and is not going to be the biggest strategic blow to Iran since the Iran-Iraq war. This had the potential, had it ended sooner, to have those type of strategic benefits. Now it's looking less and less likely. It's going to be very hard to prevent chaos, to prevent ethnic cleansing of Alawites when this is over. There may be a massacre of huge scale, both against Alawites and perhaps against Christians, who are largely seen as siding with the Assad regime.
And just finally, and as briefly as you can, David, do you think that this is now, or indeed has long since been, a fairly zero-sum proposition? Do you think there is any potential or any scope for a negotiated settlement between the rival forces in Syria now?
Bashar Assad is not the president of Syria. He's the representative of the Alawite community, and as such, he is not willingly either going to leave or cede power. That's not really a possibility. The rebels themselves, on the cusp of victory, do not appear to be inclined in the least to negotiate a situation or a solution where Assad remains in some form or is allowed to preside over an Alawite rump state and the ancestral homeland of the Alawites. This is going to be, a military solution. I don't think there's any room for a real negotiation. People may try, the Russians may try, the Venezuelans may try, the Cubans may try, the Chinese, the Iranians, to negotiate the departure of Bashar Assad. to a state that has is not a signatory to the International Criminal Court. But I think that the chances of this happening are not great. I think it's going to be very bloody and have to play its course.
That was David Shanker from the Washington Institute speaking to me earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
The bumper December-January issue of Monocle takes a look over the horizon at 2013 and beyond, introducing you to the people you need to work with, giving you an insight into which nations are on the rise, spotlighting the best in retail, and letting you eavesdrop on conversations with the leaders in everything from foreign policy to trim typography. And there's much, much more.
This month in the culture section, we tour Asia in search of the continent's best cinemas, from Bangkok's Art Deco Scala Theatre to the Singapore cinema that feels more like a first-class plane cabin. We knock on the door of the Munich retirement home set up for the city's aging journalists, artists, actors, and singers at one of the city's more enviable addresses. And we ask some of our favorite people what's on their Christmas wish list, from Danish songstress Oland to the Turkish author Elif Safak.
In the design section, we canvass the opinions of four giants from the world of graphic design. We also drop in on the UN headquarters in New York to see how the renovation of the council chamber is coming along. And we visit a perfect city bolt hole in Helsinki.
The December-January issue also includes our Turkey travel survey and is on sale now. Make sure you have all your holiday reading sorted. And remember, you can buy gift subscriptions at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Coming up, we'll find out why American school students lag behind many of their European and Asian peers in maths and science. But first, some music. This is Beirut with Nantes.
Well, it's been a long time now since I've seen you smile.
That was Beirut with Nantes, and this is Midori House on Monocle 24. In the last couple of centuries or so, the United States of America has made at least as great a contribution to the accumulated sum of human knowledge as any civilization ever gathered beneath one flag. And that's even before you start counting the really big-ticket stuff like putting men on the moon and splitting the atom. It's amazing and humbling to consider, then, what unimaginable marvels America might have accomplished if it had ever troubled to equip itself with a properly world-class school system. However, as two new reports reiterate, American schools continue to lag behind their East Asian and European counterparts in maths, or math, as Americans insist on calling it, and science. Well, joining me now to wonder what all this means is Liz Dwyer, the education editor of Good magazine. Liz, is this news, basically, or has this long been the case?
Well, you know, there's actually, in many ways, looking at the results of these tests, there's actually some good news for us in this. So one of the myths that we have is actually that America has really, you know, just fallen behind the rest of the world in academic achievement. But if you look at the original, for example, the original TIMSS results from 1995, you actually show that U.S. eighth graders were 23rd out of 41 nations. So we're actually moving up because now those same, you know, eighth graders are what, like, you know, they're up in around like 10th or so out of 56 or 57 countries. So we're really seeing some progress. I think it really depends on how you want to look at the data. And what happens when these results come out is people panic, in particular politicians panic.
Well, some of the data does look slightly, at least slightly, panic-worthy. The one about how 47 to 48% of 8th graders in Singapore and South Korea have reached advanced level maths is against 7% of American kids. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it depends on a few factors. I mean, definitely we shouldn't be proud of mediocrity here, but you know, the United States has a much more diverse group of students that they're working with. You have, for example, in high poverty schools here in the United States where the vast majority of kids are on free and reduced lunch, the scores of those schools are decidedly worse. But when you have schools where there are more middle class or wealthier children, those schools are performing on par with those other nations. So that's definitely a factor. You have to consider poverty. You have to consider the number of English language learners. You also have to consider cultures where it's a very test prep heavy culture. This particular test, it tests curriculum knowledge. So it's easy to drill on those sorts of, you know, facts and just regurgitating knowledge and things like that. But again, thinking about, you know, NASA just put we have the Mars rover Curiosity out there. And we do have amazing accomplishments. So I think that there is, again, the smart thing to do is look at what is working in the states that are accomplishing amazing things. So, for example, Massachusetts is one of the nations that has really scored well. So what are they doing there that we can learn from?
I mean, how much of the difficulty, I mean, you were talking there about cultural issues and how the children from perhaps more exam-heavy cultures have tended to do better, which would make a certain amount of sense. But what about cultural issues in the United States? How much of the lagging in science education is in any way due to the energy that needs to be expended in persuading some parts of the United States that science actually exists?
Well, it's interesting because one of the data points that was found in the results is that boys in the U.S. do better in math and science than the girls do, and then the girls are doing better in reading. So that might actually indicate that, again, some of the gender biases that we've seen for decades are still at play, that girls are still getting the message, for example, that, you know, math and science are for boys and reading and, you know, art and that sort of thing is for girls. So that might be something for folks to look at. But what's really interesting is that across the international results, what was seen is that kids who attended pre-K or had some sort of early sort of learning experiences, whether that was at home or in a formal setting, actually did better. So what that really signals is that all nations should be heavily investing in preschool programs. If you have kids coming from a low-income background or perhaps their families don't have much education, but they're put into a preschool program pretty early on, that can perhaps help to combat some of those attitudes and really set a ground level, base level knowledge base for them to work from.
So you're suggesting that what needs to be done is that education needs to start earlier?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that earlier doesn't necessarily mean, you know, sitting kids at desks and, you know, drilling them on math facts or something ridiculous like that. Kids can obviously like learn through play or learn through projects or learn through doing things. When you have, you know, a 3-year-old, they're not going to want to learn multiplication tables. But if you have them play with toys and learn, you know, their numbers or learn simple addition, you know, the things when you have low-income kids here, if they haven't gone to preschool, they come into kindergarten and they don't know how to hold a pencil necessarily. So these tests are given in fourth grade, and so if they're already behind coming into a kindergarten experience, and then by fourth grade, it's very difficult to catch them up. It's not impossible, but it's difficult.
Liz Dwyer, education editor of Good Magazine, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We've talked a bit on Monocle 24 the last couple of days what Delta Airlines' rumoured purchase of 49% of Virgin Airlines might mean. And as of earlier today, that's no longer a theoretical proposition. Delta has paid £223 million for the near half share of Virgin once held by Singapore Airlines. To discuss the repercussions, our transport editor Tristan McAllister joins us now. Tristan, good evening, or good afternoon where you are. I believe you've just touched down yourself.
Yeah, I just touched down. I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is actually a Delta hub. Good afternoon or evening to you.
Is this a bargain? It seems like one.
Yeah, it is a bit of a bargain, although it is a minority stake in the airline. If you think about what the airline has, it's 38 airplanes. A lot of those airplanes are owned by Virgin, some are leased, but the worth of those airplanes is far greater. When we look at a price like $360 million, the cost of a brand new 747 isn't much less than that. So that's the sort of money we're talking about here.
So why was Singapore so keen to sell?
You know, I think a lot of it had to do with Singapore really wanting to concentrate on what it was doing in its own market in Southeast Asia. They're under fierce competition right now in the low-cost carrier market. They've just launched their own low-cost carrier. There's a lot of reorganization with regards to alliances in Southeast Asia. And I just don't think Singapore saw Virgin as a really critical part of its plan moving forward. And again, like I was saying last night on the broadcast, Singapore doesn't have much at stake in the North Atlantic game, and I think it's a way better tie-up with Delta than it would have been with Singapore.
Well, as we also discussed last night, Richard Branson has, with his customary assertiveness, offered to bet British Airways £1 million that Virgin will still exist 5 years from now. So he seems, at least right now, to be saying that he has no intention of walking away from his 51%. But what will this effectively mean for Virgin? Will Virgin still be recognisable as Virgin when that bet's due to be settled?
It seems that that will be the case. As I said last night, Mr. Branson, or Sir Richard Branson, is very aware of his name being tied to the brand. His name is inextricably linked to it. It's a source of pride for him. I don't imagine him wanting to make it so the brand goes away. And again, a minority stake means that Delta won't have control of the airline. It just means an enhanced partnership. And if you look at the language in the press release that they released today, it essentially says that they're, quote-unquote, investing $360 million in Virgin Atlantic. So the language here doesn't seem to mean that Virgin Atlantic will be going anywhere soon, which I think, much to the chagrin of Willie Walsh at IAG, that's just the way it's going to be.
Is this basically good news for passengers?
I think ultimately it is good news for passengers. The one thing, the caveat here, is that this tie-up is pending regulatory approval here in the U.S. and overseas in Europe. And the big issue there is antitrust, locking up prices, essentially making it so passengers get gouged when it comes to ticket prices. And I don't think that's going to be an issue here. There's still plenty of competition in the market. I think that regulatory bodies will see it as a net positive for consumers. So, once that approval happens, I think they're good to go.
Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. In the next half hour of the program, we'll see if we can pick a winner in this weekend's Japanese election. We'll talk to New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik about his new book, Winter, and ask a question you may not have thought to ask before now. Is the ocean too noisy? But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, has had more surgery in Cuba today for a recurrence of cancer that has thrown his future into jeopardy. Two Britons linked to the alleged drug smuggler Lindsay Sandiford are both charged with drug trafficking in an Indonesian court today. They were arrested in May for their involvement in an alleged £1.6 million cocaine smuggling ring. Here, the UK government has condemned what it called the disgraceful attacks on police officers after 8 days of violence in Northern Ireland, following a Belfast Council decision to limit the flying of the Union flag to designated days only. United States carrier Delta Airlines has bought Singapore Airlines' 49% stake in Britain's Virgin Atlantic for $360 million and agreed a transatlantic joint venture with Virgin. An artist taking part in the Nobel Peace Prize concert in Oslo tonight said the European Union actually deserved to win the award. The concert will honour the 55-year-old organisation for helping transform Europe from a continent of wars to a continent of peace. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. Veteran New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik has a new book out called Winter, but we'd have been just as pleased to interview him if he hadn't. In his quarter century at the New Yorker, Gopnik has written with exemplary clarity and warmth on uncountable subjects, along the way collecting three National Magazine Awards and one George Polk Award for magazine reporting. Adam visited Midori House earlier today and talked to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield about the book he has just written and about writing in general.
Adam Gopnik, welcome to Midori House.
Pleasure to be here.
It's December. It's quite cold outside. You've written a book about winter. Well done. Good timing.
Yeah, absolutely.
What is it about winter that inspired you to first think about writing about this season?
Well, I've sort of become Mr. Winter in the course of doing this book. So here in chilly London, everyone says to me, well, you must be enjoying the weather. And of course, I would like to be back in Miami Beach from whence I came shortly as much as anyone. I was raised in Canada, in Montreal, which is, I suppose, one of, if not the coldest big city in the world. We get 6 feet of snow every year. And I've always loved winter. It's part of my, a piece of my complicated, everyone has a complicated identity nowadays, and mine is partly Canadian. And I wanted to understand both my own personal pull towards scenes of snowing and skiing and skating, and more generally, the kind of, for lack of a better word, the cultural gravitation that modern times has shown towards winter. Beginning sometime around 1800, winter in art, in literature, in poetry, in music, stopped being the thing you dread, and it became a thing that you were drawn to. It was a season of a certain kind of special enchantment. You see that in everything from German art to something like the popular cult of Christmas. And I wanted, if I could, to enter into that and understand some of the motives and wellsprings of that attraction.
You mentioned enchantment, but it's also, for many people, you know, a very depressing season because it's cold, it's dark. And, you know, and particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, it's, you have, yes, the lead up to Christmas and New Year, and that's all wonderful, but blimey, come January the 2nd.
We fall off a cliff. I know. It's particularly true, I think. It's not as severe, I think, curiously, maybe paradoxically, in true winter cities like Montreal, Moscow, the Scandinavian cities. In sort of midwinter cities like London and New York, we really do fall off a cliff in January 2nd. In the month of January and February in those cities, Paris too, I suppose, can be sort of unendurable. That's true. They're gray months rather than white months and hard to take for that reason. It's certainly true that one of the winter themes that you find in literature and in personal experience is endurance. It's one of the things you have to get through. But what's funny is that we don't always see it just as something to get through with our teeth gritted, but something about which getting through is itself a subject and trying to get through it. Think of something like Philip Larkin's wonderful novel, A Girl in Winter. It's winter exactly because it's about the strangulated emotions and the sexual thwarting and perversion, even you might say, of a particular kind of love affair in the 1950s. So I think that that difficulty is itself a subject and an interesting subject. It can be an epic subject in something like polar exploration. We ask, why were men driven to go all the way to the North Pole, all the way to the South Pole? And it was because exactly they wanted to see how much suffering they could take and still endure. Or it can be much more quotidian and domesticated in things like novels or films or just our own experience of getting through January and wishing we were someplace else. But there's a funny kind of paradox in it because at the same time, people who do get away, who do go south, often find themselves longing for that lost winter. One of the kind of key thematic pieces that runs through this book is that great Joni Mitchell song, The River, which is all about being a girl from Saskatchewan in Southern California at Christmas time. You remember the song, right? It's coming on Christmas, they're chopping down trees. And she's stuck in the horrible, glaring, tinsel-ridden world of Southern California, dreaming of once again being on a pond in Saskatchewan. So it works both ways.
And do you think that makes it, as a subject, you know, obviously very different from all the other seasons, and it's got so many different elements to it from enchantment to depression and everything in between.
I think it does in that way. Nobody has a hard time loving summer, and spring is the cheapest subject a poet can have, and fall is a fairly self-evident subject for a poet too, or a painter. It's about a little bit of loss, and we like a little bit of loss. Winter is deeply, deeply ambivalent. It's deeply ambivalent in our firsthand experience of it, and it's deeply ambivalent in the ways that we imagine it in art. And that's part of its appeal. There's an anxiety, even in Christmas. It's one of the things I write about in the book. is that even Christmas, which is officially a season of jubilation and joy, is actually an anxious season. It's a season of anxiety. It's never good enough. We can never love our relatives sufficiently. We can never love our relatives at all. We can never live up to the expectations that we have for the season. That's why it's simultaneously a season of light and joy, and it's a suicidal season. And I think that ambivalence is kind of braided into the DNA of our experience of winter in a way that makes it very moving and a terrific subject for writing.
I'm intrigued as to how you began writing about this subject, because this book started as a series of lectures.
Lectures, that's right.
Is there something different about the way that you prepare for and write a lecture that makes it very much unlike if you were just writing an essay?
I tried to make it so, Steve, because I wanted it to be different. I love the sound of a lecture on the page. Isaiah Berlin has done wonderful lectures that are lectures in the first instance. And I wanted this to be like that. So what I did was actually extemporize a series of lectures in the living room with the children paying no attention and the dog sighing.
Did you have an actual audience?
Children, dogs, wife, and a few friends who came downstairs and gave me notes at the end of it. And I just talked it right through. I just spoke. And then when I was done speaking, I had my wonderful assistant, Ariel, transcribed it all. And I could see what a mess it was, because we're not aware when we're talking of how much repetition, how much and how many basically's and well really's we put into it. So I stripped some of those out. I rewrote it so that it would have a little bit more finish and polish, but I wanted it to have that sense of someone somewhat breathlessly telling you about things that they had read earlier that day about the season. And I hope it has a vocal quality. My stuff on the page usually has what would be the opposite of a vocal quality, a sepulchral quality, I guess you'd have to say. Let's say lapidary quality, for lack of a better word. And I hope that this feels still like speech on the page.
As a writer, was that then part of the attraction of this, in that it was actually, it's also sort of changed the way that you write?
Absolutely. It's funny you mention that. You know, one of the things that's been really important to me in the last few years in my own work is that I joined a storytelling group in New York City called The Moth, which is just devoted to the lost art of storytelling. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, no notes, tell a story to a group. And it's been terrific for me because it reminded me of the necessity for a certain kind of linear propulsion in writing. And similarly, exactly, doing this, as opposed to the kinds of essays I normally write, reminded me that you can lose a certain amount in finish and gain a great deal in force. And I hope that this is forceful in that way. And as I say, I love the sound of speech on the page, and it's very different from the look of writing, the feel of writing on the page. And as I say, you lose something. You know, I look through this book now, and often on pages I'll say, oh my God, I repeated the word intense 5 times in a page, which I never normally would do. But maybe that gives it a certain intensity.
Well, yes, and when you're actually doing the lecture, that word then
comes to mind again and again. I made an odd discovery, actually, in the course of doing the lectures, which is that the normal rhythm of English, at least, I don't know if this is true about any other language, is you make a statement, then you expand on that statement, and then you try to compress that statement. That's the way we talk when we're trying to explain something. So I'll say, I have a kind of special affinity for sweaters. Is something about sweaters, whether they're wool or artificial, that I think is essential to my sense of myself. I am a wool man. So you have kind of saying the same thing 3 times, and it's very natural. And I kept in some of that rhythm in the book that I might have taken out had I been approaching it just as a written assignment.
Have you actually then found that this has affected your writing in different ways when you're doing different things? In the same way that if you're reading a lot of 19th century novels while you're also trying to write an essay about the Republican Party, suddenly you'll use phrases and terms that you really wouldn't have done otherwise.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a terrible zealot when it comes to those things. You know, whatever I read last kind of seeps its way into my writing. So if I'm reading Trollope, suddenly, so to speak, everybody is drinking port in my pages. And I think that happens. I think it's bound to happen. I think that one of the things at a very practical level that I've discovered, I live kind of two lives, both of them extremely dull, but nonetheless, two of them. One is a writer and one is a lecturer. And having to do this book of writing as lectures has made me, whenever I'm kind of stuck in a piece now, I simply pull away from the keyboard and I will say it and I will listen to myself speaking. And very often your tongue is smarter than your mind is, in a funny way, that when you have to articulate something, it's the way musicians, if you ever watch a, wonderful guitar players sort of compose, their fingers are smarter than they are. They follow their fingers rather than imposing an order on the fretboard. And I think you can do that somewhat as a writer. I certainly talk my stuff more than I did before. Very reassuring for my wife hearing a madman soliloquizing in the middle of the night.
Now, you did these lectures back in 2010 originally?
11. A year ago, okay, exactly.
So 2011. So this is the first winter since you finished the lectures and the book. What are the things that you've seen or you've picked up or you've experienced in your first winter since finishing this book that you think, you know, if I was going to write a sequel, or I should have really sort of alighted on that?
Two things. One is that I think that there is a kind of prehistory. My book really begins in the 19th century, which is really when attention to winter in this sense, this intense way begins. But there's a long prehistory. I didn't get to write about Shakespeare's Winter's Tale or Bruegel or those things. That's one thing. But at a deeper level, and this is one of the real paradoxes of writing, is that you're drawn to subjects because they have an obsessive hold on you, whether it's Paris or child rearing or winter in this way. You can't kind of let it drop and you're obsessed with it and you feel compelled to produce something about it because you want to turn the talk in your mouth into words on a page. And then once you've done it, it drops away as a subject of obsessive interest to you. I found that even about Paris. You know, I wrote a book about Paris, and of course I still love Paris, but I don't love Paris the way I did before I wrote the book about it. And now, then you have to become sort of a polite, sort of official relation of your own old obsession. So people say, oh, you must not wait to be able to get back to Paris. Say, oh, absolutely, I can't wait. And the truth is, deep inside yourself, you're saying, I am a little finished with Paris. And I will confess, I am a little finished with winter in the sense I have to walk around now being Mr. Winter.
At least you don't have to talk about it all the time. Yes.
The cold. And the truth is, it's in the nature of, if you produce a memory on the page, in a certain way, you lose the memory. And if you explore an obsession on the page, in an odd way, you might say it cures the obsession, but in some way, you lose the obsession.
And that was The New Yorker's Adam Gopnik with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield discussing Adam's new book, Winter and Matters Arising. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with some music and then a check-in from Tokyo on Japan's imminent parliamentary elections.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
It's time for another song from Sweden now. This is the imaginatively named Peter Bjorn and John with It Don't Move Me. That was Peter, Bjorn and John with It Don't Move Me. You're listening to Midori House. Japan votes in parliamentary elections this weekend, which means that the extraordinary 40% of Japanese who still haven't apparently made up their minds should brace themselves for a frenzy of last-minute importuning. Despite this large-scale bewilderment and or indifference, observers seem generally convinced that former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and his Liberal Democrats will be returned to power, and that current Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda and his Democratic Party of Japan should begin soliciting quotes from removalists. Earlier, Emma Nelson and our man in Tokyo, Kenji Hall, contemplated the runes.
According to public broadcaster NHK's recent poll, it looks as if the LDP, the Liberal Democrats, are now expected to win anywhere between 257 to 306 seats in the 480-seat lower house. That would return the LDP to power after 3 years in the opposition.
The LDP, as you say, destined to go back into power, but it was only a temporary time that they weren't in fact in power, wasn't it?
The LDP had been in power for most of the post-war period until they were kicked out by voters 3 years ago. The rise of the Democratic Party was in some ways voters' way of saying, you know, we're sick of politics as usual. 3 years later, it looks as if, you know, voters are now saying we're tired of political change because political change doesn't in fact work. And so, really, this is a sign that the DPJ, the Democratic Party, has failed in delivering the policies that it had promised.
There's still a huge number of voters undecided, though, isn't there?
That's right. Current opinion polls suggest that the LDP has about 27% of voter support. The Democratic Party has about 16%. But there's a huge number of undecided voters, about 40%. So at this point, there's still some uncertainty out there, but really, I think what we'll see is the LDP returning to power.
So when, as you say, the LDP returned to power, what would a Japan under the LDP and Shinzo Abe look like?
So Shinzo Abe is a former prime minister. He was prime minister back September 2006 to September 2007. The new Shinzo Abe, that he's sort of rebranded himself as, would essentially pressure the Bank of Japan to adopt more radical policies to beat deflation and weaken the yen, which, you know, a strong yen has really hurt Japan's exporters. He'd also get tough against China on things like the dispute with China over islands in the East China Sea. And also, you know, he suggested a fairly radical revision of the pacifist constitution that would give the military more powers or more authority to act like a military. Right now, it's called the Self-Defense Forces, and in many ways, it's not allowed to do many of the things that you would expect a military to do.
So we have that to come, perhaps, if the LDP get into power. What will the parties be doing between now and the weekend? Because obviously the Democratic Party of Japan, the DPJ, under Yoshihiko Noda, have got all the work to do.
That's right. So mostly what we'll see are these vans riding around the city. This is in Tokyo, blaring their messages from these loudspeakers. It's quite noisy during campaign season because, you know, there are tight restrictions on campaigning over the internet. There's still some debate as to whether Twitter is a permissible way of reaching voters. It's very, very old school, very traditional. There's been a lot of debate about this. So mostly what we'll see are these, you know, vans riding around town, screaming their messages. And so the noise pollution over the next few days will be quite substantial.
And that was Kenji Hall in Tokyo talking to Emma Nelson. This is Midori House. The sound of the sea is generally held to be almost proverbially soothing. However, this is decreasingly the case if you're one of the creatures that lives in it. Human activity at sea, shipping, exploration, mining, tourism, is rendering the oceans distractingly clamorous. Rendering, I tell you. Sound, it is often forgotten, travels better through water than air. And you may well be asking at this point, well, so what? But then you're not a whale. And apologies at this point to our few but ardent whale listeners. Whales, among other sea life, depend depend on their hearing to locate food and each other. The US Navy estimates that its own sonar damages the hearing of at least 250,000 sea creatures annually. Well, now the United States government's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is embarking on the first attempt to document submarine noise pollution. And I'm joined by the co-director of the project now, marine biologist Leela Hatch. Leela, how big a problem is this?
Well, it's quite a large problem in terms of the scale that we're measuring the problem at, which is finally coming into the same ecological scales that animals operate on in the ocean, which are ocean basins. So we're starting to understand that this noise is pervasive and there aren't that many places in the ocean that are left free of the influence of human activities.
And how are you able to measure the damage or distress it causes sea life?
Well, that's a whole other ball of wax. We've been starting on the documentation phase of characterizing the problem, characterizing the extent over which human contributions of noise can be recorded, and also predicting the areas over which these sounds are being transmitted, asking the question, how are we going to mitigate the effects that this earth is having on animals, involves a whole other phase of knowledge about how exactly they may be coping with this more chronic, insidious type of noise, not that sharp bang that happens near you, but the chronic background noise that is increasingly part of your everyday life.
And does this just affect whales and other sea-going mammals, seals, dolphins, porpoises, etc., or does this affect all marine life?
Their sound is such a pervasive sensory sense in the underwater environment that there are not many marine animals that don't utilize it in some way. Invertebrates and many species of fish, some of the most commercially important fishery species, are known to be very acoustically active. And it's a problem far beyond marine mammals, though we have tended to focus on marine mammals due to our legislative need to manage their recovery.
And is it just the United States government that's looking into this, or is there international interest in the problem?
There is a great deal of international interest in the problem. The EU's Marine Strategies Directive specifically called out questions about the influence of ocean noise on marine life and has begun to direct energies towards better understanding of the issue at scales relevant to the EU. Other nations have taken real strides forward as well. This U.S.-led effort directed at sort of finer resolution documentation of human influence in our exclusive economic zone really does just beg for partnerships, because noise does not pay any attention to those boundaries.
Leela Hatch, marine biologist working on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's attempt to map the noise of the oceans. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. And that's all we have time for on today's episode. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Next on Monocle 24, we join Hugo MacDonald for Section D, where we'll find out about Hong Kong joining up with Denmark for the Business of Design Week.
Asia is a huge market for Danish design, and it should be bigger. It's very difficult for a small country to penetrate the Asian market. The way you do business in the design world in Scandinavia and the way it's done in Asia is quite different.
In a squeak over 3 hours from now, at 2200 hours here in London, I'll be back with Tom Burgess Watson for the Monocle Daily. And as if that wasn't enough, I'll also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.